Good morning. You're listening to 42 Minutes, a production of ThinkBook Radio and thethinkbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is episode number 88. Today is June 11th, and William Morgan and I are going to investigate the secrets in plain sight. And we'll do that with our guest, Mr. Scott Onstott. Scott is an architect, author, researcher, and filmmaker. He is responsible for the Secrets in Plain Sight film series, which is into its second volume and which is available for purchase at his website, secretsinplainsight.com. Scott is the author of a number of software and design books and the producer of educational videos. For more information regarding his professional work, check out his professional website, scottonstott.com. Last year, he contributed a chapter to the Sync Book Volume 2 entitled Synchronicity in Number. Currently, he is writing a book called Structures of Reality, Exploration in Number, Architecture, and Cosmos. Exciting stuff. Welcome, Scott. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. I see on your website that you have a book called Taking Measure available.
Yes, Taking Measure is actually the title. I changed the title from Structures of Reality to Taking Measure. And it's already available. So what you see in the Sync Book 2 was written before I finished writing Taking Measure.
Wonderful. I'm going to have to check it out. Before we get into your area of research, can we talk a little bit about Dan Brown?
Sure, yeah. He was an inspiration to me initially getting me interested in some of the issues that I delved into in Secrets in Plain Sight, Volume 1. And I mentioned him right at the beginning of my film.
Okay, but so he has a brand new book. And, I mean, so he's into a lot of the interesting things that we're talking about. But are you reading The Inferno?
I'd like to. I haven't started that yet.
Okay.
Yeah. I understand it's about Dante's Inferno, and you know, it's interesting that there's 33, I don't know if it's canticles or portions of each one of his books. And, you know, 33 is a number that I'm really familiar with. It's a really important number that I go into in my work.
Huh. And in your piece in Sync Book 2, you went into 33 in quite a bit of depth as well. The thing is about...
I had a whole laundry list of 33s in that article in the Sync Book.
Yeah, all the way down to the spine, to Jesus, Middle C, the Muslim lunar year calendar. But the thing about Dan Brown's is it's so conspiracy set, and I really didn't get the feeling of conspiracy through your work.
You get a feeling that it's a conspiracy? Is that right?
No, not from your work, but Dan Brown seems to be... That's how he tells a story. There always has to be a bad guy. You're not of the same school, though, are you?
No, well, I think conspiracy is certainly interesting, but that's not my focus. I see, if you will, I see conspiracy at a deeper level or a higher level that's built into the very fabric of reality. And so I don't see it as a human conspiracy, you know, as much as a sort of mystical conspiracy.
So, just to be clear, what would you say your field of study is? Like, how would you characterize what you do?
Well, that's hard to put into words, but it has to do with recognizing patterns around us in the world. And it's led me into a deep study of number and sacred geometry. And noticing these geometric and numerical patterns that are all around us in plain sight. It's just that when you draw your attention to them, you can be amazed and, you know, move into a state of wonder and mystery and questioning, and it leads you to ever more and more interesting questions.
So then...
When you pursue this.
My curiosity is, so I think your work is fabulous. Does going into this, like, look at the synchronicity of physical structures, does it make the mysteries more clear, or does it make the mystery even more mysterious?
Well, the mystery remains a mystery, and if you were able to fully explain it, it would no longer be a mystery. Although we have the urge to try to explain it as best we can, and I'm always trying to be more clear about it, but no matter how much I do try to explain it, it sort of still remains a mystery. So you just have to be a lover of mystery, I guess, to want to continue researching in these areas.
Well, I like the way that earlier, just a few minutes ago, how you said that it gives you more questions. We didn't say anything about answers.
Yeah, well, answers come here and there, but they lead you on to more interesting questions, I suppose. It's really a questioning process that I like, that leads me on to, greater revelations, I suppose.
So then how did the Secret in Plain Sight video series develop? And how much time did it take?
Well, the first one, Volume 1, is actually almost like a double feature because it runs almost 4 hours long. And it took me a whole year to write that and to put it together and produce it. And that was like an all-consuming passion. I took a year off of work and just did that. And then
and you knew that was the project from the start.
I knew I was dedicated to researching this, and it all was sort of generated because I talked to this woman who's claims to be a intuitive, and she just basically gave me the information that I was going to be making a video, and she didn't tell me what it was about, and somehow that was just enough of a kick to get me to take that seriously. And then I started thinking, well, if I was going to make a video, what would it be about? And this whole cascade of stuff came out in brainstorming. And then the script really wrote itself very quickly. And it just took a while to edit it and get it, smooth out all the rough edges. And then the most time was finding all the images and doing the technical side of putting together the film.
Well, it's a wonderful film. The interesting thing to me is, so it comes off as a really learned piece of material. Not my own work tends to be more dilettantish, but there's a real academic feel. You cite all these different authors, and so it seems like you've been researching this stuff for years and years and years. Is that?
Well, it is. I've been reading a lot, and I think Secrets in Plain Sight Volume 1 was really the last 10 years of my reading sort of put into the creative effort. And I was ready to do that because I've been writing these software books for more than 10 years. So I'm used to really looking at a lot of detail and trying to summarize that in a clear way. And, maybe it comes across as academic or whatever because of all the software training I have in teaching AutoCAD and 3ds Max and SketchUp and Photoshop.
Well, sure, there was a lot of technical education that you had to go through as well.
Yeah, well, I'm really good with software, so the technical side was easy for me.
I mean, this was a lone project all by yourself?
That's right. It was a one-man show.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
It seems like science often, and so let's just say the paradigm of our particular place in time right now is scientific materialism. There are certain aspects of this kind of stuff that they just don't want to, scientific materialism doesn't want to look at. So what, I'm thinking about like from a maybe even architectural standpoint where, the idea that you're encoding meaning into your structure. I'm just wondering, you're saying you did a lot of reading, over the past 10 years to create Secrets in Plain Sight. Was it a slow movement into this kind of paranormal space, or have you always been interested in, you know, the
Fordian subjects?
Yeah.
No, it was a slow movement in there, and I think it was coinciding with when I moved to where I live now is a rather remote island in British Columbia called Cortez Island. And when I came here is when I started opening up and exploring more unconventional subject matter. And, you know, it just happened to coincide with the move to this quiet place. I don't know. That's probably just a simple coincidence there. I don't think there's any causality there.
There's nothing spooky about that island then?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, now I would like to read a passage, just a short sentence that you have in your piece in the Think Book 2, and it goes, "In the last decade, I have grown to appreciate the piling up of these so-called coincidences as evidence of a deep structuring to reality bearing the unmistakable signature of consciousness." I mean, could you expand upon what you mean by that a little?
Well, I see that the world stuff is equivalent to mind stuff. And it really makes you, when you look at a lot of this evidence that I present, it might help you to see that a little more. That it's not that there's an us and a world, it's actually all consciousness. And maybe I can give you a more concrete example to give you just a taste of that. So let's consider a circle and a square. Really simple. The circle, you know, is a beautiful shape. It's sort of perfect in that it's defined as all the points equidistant from one center. It represents heaven, if you will, or maybe the feminine principle because it's curved. And a square is, you could say it's masculine, straight lines, more like Earth,
robust.
South, east, and west. Yeah. And so when we compare these two, it's like bringing male and female together, or it's like bringing heaven and earth together. Okay, so if you put a circle inside a square so that it's just perfectly touching the square, so it's inscribed in the square, then if you look at the area, the square has 27.3% more area than the circle. Okay, just keep that number in mind. And if you look at it differently...
The number 23, that's not that hard to keep in mind.
No, 27.3. Okay, if you look at it... Yeah, if you look at it differently, if you compare the circle and the square so that the circle's circumference is the same as the square's perimeter, then that's called squaring the circle. And if you do that, the circle's diameter is 27.3% larger than the edge of the square. So, I mean, that's an interesting sort of geometrical fact, that when you compare lengths and when you compare areas, they give you the same number. But what really is interesting is that the moon happens to be 27.3% the size of the Earth.
And it's this kind of stuff that kind of blows my head up when I watch Secrets in Plain Sight.
Yeah, it's like there's a lot of, you have to have kind of a little bit of a, allow the technical side to happen. And it's a lot easier if you see the visuals than just listening to me take you through it, you know, verbally. But because then you have your left and your right brains working together, basically. But let me just give you a couple more facts, and just to give you the sense of the mystery of this. The moon's sidereal orbital period is 27.3 days. And human gestation lasts, on average, 273 days. Okay, so that's really beautiful that all of these things, how do I say, they synchronize with this particular ratio or number. And why is that? There's nothing that it should be the same, right? Why would the human gestation be 273 days. And why would a sidereal month be that same value, but in days, 27.3? So it's somehow the decimal system is related to this.
Well, the 237 has often, because we just, room 237, we just interviewed the director of it recently. And if you watch that movie, because of the movie The Shining and everything, the number 237 has been associated with the moon a lot. So, they're kind of mixed up with the 27.3.
But same numbers, it's important. Yeah, it could be related to the same phenomena. And one more fact, the last fact I have about it, is that water becomes liquid 273 degrees Celsius above absolute zero. So, again, how is water implicated in that? Somehow, it makes sense that water is like Earth, the water planet, and somehow this all just ties back to the simplicity of comparing a circle to a square.
Well, I wonder, you see all of this, apparently intentional lattice work of all of creation. How do you fit inside of it? Do you feel directed to a certain extent on your ideas of these things and what you come across and when you come across it?
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm on a ride and I'm just following the path and these things just fall in my lap and I notice them. And when I'm really in that way, it's like every time I look at the clock, it's 11:11 or 2:22 or 1:234. It's 12:34. These numbers start popping up in my daily reality. And this happens to lots of people, but I feel that when that starts happening to you, you should pay attention to it. It's like a signal that from the world to, I don't know. It's hard to explain.
That when you are speaking about the moon and the connection between the moon and the number 108, it's at 108. Like the counter on the video is also at 108. So like you encoded the same structure in the time frame of your own video.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't mean to do that. That's great. And I noticed in the Sync Book 2, my article begins on page 314, which is like pi.
Yeah.
And that I don't know if that was intentional or not. It wasn't. I wasn't aware of that when I submitted the article. But I think that's a nice little synchronicity.
Yeah.
And, 108 is another one of those incredible numbers that,
well, your article ends on 327,
which is
okay.
237.
We're talking the same digits as 27.3%.
Yeah, because I often seen the same, not those particular numbers, but when I see group number pairings, whatever order they are, it's still the same thing, and repetitive digits or a one and a zero added basically boil down to the same thing, in my opinion. But
that's right. I think that there's something about the decimal system being universal and not just anthropomorphic because we have 10 fingers. And I go into some of the reasons for that in my book, Taking Measure. But it's the 9 digits, 1 through 9, that are what everything boils down to. And that's because of the decimal system. And I think that a great mirror of that is in the ancient Egyptian Ennead of the 9 gods that they worship there in Heliopolis. You can use that as sort of a mirror of the deep structuring to reality. It's based on these numbers 1 through 9. I think number is sort of like getting down to the machine language of the matrix, if you will.
Which is...
It just gets right there.
Okay, so, well, this is kind of opening a portal to my curiosities, which is, so you're talking about the deep structure of the architecture of everything, totality, you know, not just consciousness, but the actual structures that consciousness creates, you know, and so we're talking about how the human being, the separation between the idea of the moon and a human being, you know, you begin to see that there's no separation as far as, you know, we're all the same stuff because the same architecture is encoded in the moon that's in us. But
that's right.
The interesting thing to me is now we're dealing in digital structures, and you would think that if we're creating, you know, we become gods and we're creating our own worlds digitally, that they would also naturally just encode those same principles. But it's curious because it seems like the fictions now take on this flavor that reality is an illusion. So you have the Matrix or the 13th floor, and that the realities that we're dealing with aren't actually real, which is kind of this digital idea. But when we're dealing with material, there's more of a tangibility to the structures. I'm just wondering how you reconcile these two different notions, you know, reality
it's like there's three steps. In the first step, you are a separate self, a separate consciousness, and there's a world out there. I think in Zen, they would say in the beginning, there's mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And then you can have a transcendent realization that mountains and rivers are not real, and that only your awareness is real. Only Brahman is real. And that's halfway.
Right.
And then to come all the way home, you realize that Brahman is the world, that your consciousness is what everything is made of. You are everything. So then you come back to saying mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, but with a totally different perspective, that they're not separate from you, that you are immanent in the mountain and in the river and in all things, and that there can't be more than one consciousness here, that in fact there's only one awareness, and we all are sharing that. So this is the core of, I think, many religions and mystical traditions. It takes you through those three steps. And I guess I'm when I made Secrets in Plain Sight, I wasn't aware of that as I've just said it now. That's been a very more recent understanding that I've come to.
So you were only in phase two then?
I was earlier, yes. But now I'm realizing all three steps are important, and I see that's where I was trying to head with Secrets in Plain Sight, is coming back to realizing the immanence, not only the transcendence of that we are, that our awareness transcends reality, but that we are also immanent and here now and in everything, in the core of everything. So, I mean, when you look at an atom, when scientists go out into the universe and they study everything, and let's say they look all the way down into the smallest scale and they look inside of an atom and they look for what's in there, and they find that it's mostly 99.999% nothing. But the something that I think is there is really more just relationships to other things. And so it becomes more clear that the fabric of reality is really just awareness. And that's from looking out into the world. But if you look into yourself, if you go into yourself and study the inner landscape in your awareness like a mystic, you come to the same realization. You see, so going inside leads you to the sense that all is consciousness, and going outside and studying the world, studying the large structures in the cosmos all the way down to the smallest structures, leads you to the same conclusion if you dare to go all the way. And that's a really totally different view than I used to have 10 years ago, say, of just scientific materialism, of thinking that my consciousness was inside my head and I was separate from everything else and from the world. And so this, I think the Sync book and synchronicity is about recognizing that interconnection in ways that defy causality, and recognizing this all-pervading consciousness as the ground of all being. Would you guys agree with that?
Definitely. I guess part of my line of reasoning, it seems like I'm trying to strike a balance oftentimes. So like a purely mystical approach sometimes is really, really threatening to me, because it seems like transcendence transcends material at some point, and then because it transcends material, you end up with the transcendent consciousness actually being the favored over material, so therefore we can do anything because consciousness is reigns supreme. And so one of the things,
right, and that's like the, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but one of the things that we were arriving at is this idea of enlightenment in the body. So like the fusing of material and consciousness, material imbued with consciousness, so that, you're packing more and more density into material, I guess. But, I've totally lost my train of thought.
Well, I think your fear is coming from that halfway station, just step two of the three-step process.
I'll reconnect it to Dan Brown's newest book, The Bad Guy thinks that humanity's become a plague upon the earth, and the only way that you can reach enlightenment is to go through the fire, the inferno, or
the inferno.
Room 237. So you have to go into the darkness to reach the light. And so, but he's playing on our world fears about overpopulation and superflus and plagues and things.
See, that's the real conundrum to this whole situation. If the world is consciousness and everything seems to have some kind of intention, for lack of a better term, to it, then where does all the suffering come from? And what is the...
Yeah, suffering, it comes from identification with the illusion that, it comes from the separate self, a feeling separated from reality, from the totality. Feeling that you're alone. It's really just a shift of awareness to who you really are, I guess. To realizing that you are both transcendent and immanent is sort of the cure for suffering.
But there's still the realization of time. I mean, there's still sooner or later we're all going to be in a pine box, if you get what I'm saying. Like, and that's not necessarily my definition of suffering, but it's just it gets to the point where you're asking, what's the practical application? And I'm not attacking your or anybody else's work, because I'm in this field too. It's just, it's kind of hard to relay the information if a person's not already on that path. Like, if a person has already seen a couple of sinks, and then you start giving them a little bit more information, and then it leads them to something else. But for somebody who's more interested in NFL, and synchronicity is a very hard thing to explain to somebody, because it's almost invariably you had to be there situation. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, it's sort of self-selecting for those people that are already like on the threshold of it, who are really wanting to know more, but you can't just, you know, pound it. You can't go preaching to everyone about it because they won't care about it or want to hear it.
Right. They think you're a nutter.
Yeah. Yeah. And that should be fine. You know, it's not like you have to go and convert everybody to whatever view you hold.
So you don't see this as a religion, and you're not looking for converts at all.
No, absolutely not. It's something that you have to verify for yourself, and you know that's why I you know cite all the references and give all the data, and you can verify it and check it out yourself, and don't take my word for anything, you know, and find out. I'm just telling you what I've found out. So, it's not a belief system at all. It's just an investigation, an open investigation that I'm engaged in.
Well, one of the fascinating things that I encountered was, a year or two ago, I read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And it's interesting how oftentimes, you know, the early scientists, they didn't, you know, they were just feeling their way in the dark also. And their discoveries led to new paradigms of, you know, scientific understanding of, you know, interaction with reality. And I sometimes wonder if that isn't what, you know, is going on with our group as well.
We're laying down the foundation for a new paradigm?
Maybe.
Yeah. You know, we're using the scientific method in a sense.
Well, some of us at least.
Reality and, you know, observing reality and yeah, doing thought experiments, and so on. It's a proven approach, you know. Being rational is a good way to approach things, and yet to use those tools to find out where that seems to break down in the world, where cause it seems like we can seemingly violate the laws of causality with some of these things we're finding.
Yeah.
Well, see, okay, somewhere, I don't know how to articulate it, but we're batting around this concept of useful. I mean, at the very end of your piece, you mentioned lottery numbers.
Yeah.
And so, like, because I find it very difficult. It almost seems like I don't think I've been able to willfully control the situation. I seem to have a more, it's almost like a path. It's like, okay, I know I'm going the right direction, so I'll just keep, and I find little treasures in here, but they've never been anything that has necessarily like benefited me financially. And even if I was benefited financially, it has always been of just what I needed at that time. It has never been a surplus of anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I just don't think it works that way, where you would just aggrandize your own separate self and, you know, buy a mansion or something with all this money. The money comes to you as you need it. Yeah. You'll be provided for, you know, by the universe in a way. Like I live in a forested area where there's a lot of deer, and the deer have everything they need to eat just naturally. They don't have to worry about, oh God, what am I going to do for a living? And, you know, they don't worry about it, and it all comes to them. And, you know, we have to worry about having a living, but I don't know what your experience is, but mine has been, I've always had just enough. Just the right amount comes in seemingly at the last minute. So maybe it's not that different than just being a deer in the sense that everything is provided for.
But there's this strange interplay between the right and the left brain a little bit, where the deer is kind of the right brain, and the human creature who is worried about tomorrow, or maybe 3 weeks from tomorrow, you know, I need to have food for 3 weeks from tomorrow. And so then we create this. So like that is one of the questions that at the root of a lot of my thought comes down to, you know, how much sense does civilization really make with our structures and rules and this sort of stuff? Have you thought about like humanity as a thing, the structure of humanity and where is it heading, and you know what's in store for us as a people in the future?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I don't claim to be a prophet in knowing the future, but I guess it comes down to me being fundamentally optimistic about our future. There's a lot to be pessimistic about, but when it comes down to it, ultimately I recognize that I'm optimistic.
So, and because of your research in the last decade, do you think that optimism has been a product of that? Are you more optimistic now than you were when you began this journey?
Yes, I am. I felt that the research I did was really uplifting me and making me see these really deep patterns in the universe somehow really comforts me. That all is consciousness is a huge revelation. Going from feeling totally separated to feeling totally included in all things is a huge shift. I'm still working the implications out of that one, you know, but that's a tremendous case for optimism, as I see it.
So then do you think, you know, why do you think so many of the people that are tapping into the structures, say like the Masons, you know, why is that a secret? Why do you think they kept their knowledge secret for a time?
Well, I think that it was very appropriate to keep any knowledge secret in times gone by because of it being suppressed by the powers that be, primarily in the church. So, you know, in those days, there was only one view of reality, the official view. And if you had anything that differed from that, you could be burned at the stake even. So it was important to keep it secret. And now it doesn't seem that there's that kind of pressure, so secrets come out more. But maybe just by the weight of the tradition of maintaining this structure, the Freemasons, you know, they have their rituals and stuff, but they're not really a secret. You can read books about Freemasonry. You can find out what the rituals are. It's not a secret society. Everybody knows about the Freemasons. It's an open secret, really. So if that's something that interests you, you can investigate it and find out everything that they have there. I don't claim that the Freemasons are behind any conspiracy, but they seem to certainly use some of the same numbers that are part of the architecture of the universe. And they hold things in sort of the same awe that I do. And they have no exclusive ownership of that knowledge. They just happen to be one of the many mystery schools that has transmitted some of this knowledge.
Well, it definitely seems like whether or not it's intentional or not, you know, this stuff is going to come out in whatever you produce, but then there's definite intentionality with the connection of capital cities and the Masons and this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's difficult to know where the decisions are made. Like, were the decisions made in a group of Freemasons who planned the location of certain buildings or even the whole design of cities? Or was that even a deeper conspiracy in the sense that people just sort of felt inspired to do it a certain way and they didn't really know why? They just did it that way.
Well, there was even...
And yet...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, there's even like a little tidbit that Dan Brown threw out in The Lost Symbol about how they laid the cornerstone, you know, on several important building sites only when the Caput Draconis was in the Virgin, you know, and he didn't ever explain that. And I thought that was like one of those funny little Dan Brown things. Which
the head of the dragon was in the Virgin.
Yes.
There's a sexual thing there.
Yeah. But
no shit.
It had to do with the moon and the sun being in alignment. You know, the seed
right.
and the egg.
But what I'm saying is that these things sometimes happen without our conscious awareness of them. Usually they are happening. In fact, they're happening all the time all around us. And we're only in a process of discovering the secrets in plain sight. And it's one valid viewpoint to say that there's a group of there's a secretive group of people that know everything and that they are behind it all. But I think that is really not ultimately, for me, it's not ultimately the right answer. Because if Freemasons planned cities and stuff, did they also design the size of the moon? And, you know, how far are you going to take this? You know? And there's just too much for me that I've seen to make me think that it's all just a human conspiracy. So it gets more into the nature of reality itself for me, rather than the Illuminati being the bad guy and we can blame everything on them.
Well, I mean, once you say that everything is consciousness, it pretty much includes all individuals as well. If you think of it like a computer program, that means that the overall system would have a back door into all the other systems. So even conspiracy, or the ones who try to use conspiracy, would be part of the bigger whole as well. Does that make sense?
Exactly. That's a huge important revelation, to realize all these guys that you demonize or see as rightly being bad guys are part of your same awareness. So maybe they're like our shadow elements, you see, but they're still part of our awareness.
Okay, I'm sorry, but that's 42 minutes. Thank you. You've been listening to Scott Onstott on 42 Minutes, a production of ThinkBook Radio on thethinkbook.com. More information about the work of Mr. Onstott, and the Secrets of Plain Sight. It's not going to happen.
Well, let him finish his sentence. It's quite all right.
Go ahead, Scott.
Oh, just that, maybe these you know, bad guys and that we identify in the world are really part of us ultimately. So
the dark matter.
When you see that, it takes the pointing your finger away, and you can point your finger right at yourself.